time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for August 4th, 2018. Doesn't seem possible that it's August already. I want to mention one news item that I found very disturbing this week, and yes, it did involve the death of two cyclists, but not in the way we usually have to report. Jay Austin and Lauren Geohagen, both from Washington, D.C., were killed in what appears to be a terrorist attack in Tajikistan last Sunday. While the Islamic State claims to have perpetrated the attack, which killed two other cyclists besides Jay and Lauren, authorities in Tajikistan did not accept that claim, instead blaming a banned political party for the attack. The two cyclists had quit their 9-to-5 jobs and were on a round-the-world bicycle tour. And when these incidents touch so close to home, because I think we can all relate to traveling by bike, it makes us wary and afraid. The details of the attack are brutal, and rather than relating them here, you can go to the online Washington Post for July 31st and search for the article titled DC Cyclists Killed in Islamic State Claimed Attack in Former Soviet Central Asia. So on a less somber note, our next big stage race, the 73rd edition of the Vuelta a España, will begin with an individual time trial on August 25th in Malaga, in the south of Spain, and finish in Madrid on the 18th of September. Chris Froome has yet to win this event, and with his loss at this year's Tour de France, we'll have to see whether he can finally stand on the top of the podium at this iconic race. We'll see. So let's move on to this week's show. As promised, I am joined by Dave Moulton. Now in his 80s, I would venture to say that he's still as sassy, interesting, and well-informed as he was in the heyday of his frame building, which we will discuss. As you'll hear, he's built thousands of frames, he's written books and writes songs, and has a wickedly good sense of humor. He recalls his days as a boy in England, as well as his reasons for riding a bicycle in the first place. He'll remind us of terms we haven't heard in years, give us his views on carbon, e-bikes, and sew-up tires, and offer us his ideas on geometry and frame sizing. I'm sure we missed something, but we do end with the promise of another visit sometime soon. I hope you enjoy listening to the conversation as much as I enjoyed being engaged in it. Hi, Dave. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Oh, good. Well, you know, my listeners have been asking that I have a conversation with you, and everybody thinks you're both venerable and iconic, and I think that the world of frame building and bicycling would like to hear from you. So here we are.
Well, it's nice of you to say that. Thank you.
So I'd like to start way back. I've read a lot of your blog, which is very extensive and very interesting. And I do know a little bit about your younger days, but talk to us about where you grew up and before frame building, what you were doing.
Yeah, well, I started out in London, in the East End of London. My father was a stevedore, worked on the docks, unloading and loading ships. And then the war came, and he went off to war. And there was, because of the bombing, there was a bomb fell in the street behind us and blew out all the windows in our homes. And then right after that, we evacuated. And I was fortunate that my mother came with me. You know, a lot of kids were evacuated and went into foster care. But my mother came with me, and we moved to down to the south of England in the rural area. And we lived there. And then after the war, my father went back to his job on the docks. He lived there for a while in East End of London, but it was a very rough area, a lot of crime, and not good. And my mother talked him into moving to Luton, which is a town about 30 miles north of London. It's an industrial town, and we moved there. And that really changed my whole life, because that's where we got into cycling. My father bought me a brand new bike. It was a heavy roadster bike, but it had drop handlebars. So to me, it was a racing bike, but it had drop handlebars. It must have weighed about 40 pounds. But my father and I didn't get along, and I found it was best to stay away from him. So I went out and rode my bike all the time just to stay out of the house and avoid the dysfunctional family kind of thing going on. So at the age of 13, you know, I was riding weekends. I was riding as much as 100 miles on this big, heavy old bike. And evening too, riding around until it got dark. So that's how I got into cycling. And then I went to a technical college, and there was a lot of people went to that college who were racing cyclists, and they had all these lightweight bikes in the bike rack, and every break time I'd be out there hanging my nose over these bikes, and I fell in love with a lightweight bike, and I realized I wanted one. So my first lightweight bike was a Dawes, a modest kind of bike. But I joined a cycling club, and that's what got me into it. And I had to wait until I was 16 years old before I could race. And I was putting in a lot of miles. And when I started racing, I was really fit and did really well right from the start. And I had people telling me that I was good at something, which is something I hadn't experienced before. So that's what got me into cycling.
That's a wonderful story. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. So you had your Dawes, and then you got, what was your next bike after the Dawes?
Yeah, well, we had a local frame builder named Pop Hodge. Named Albert Hodge, we called him Pop. Now, he was about my age at that time. He was born in 1977. So this was in the 1950s, so he was getting close to 80 by then. He was still building frames. And he built me a frame. And to defer some of the cost of this, I filed the lugs on the frame, which are very intricate filing. I was an apprentice engineer, so I did these lugs at work when I should have been working on other stuff. But that defrayed the cost of the frame. And then I did such a good job that he allowed me to file other lugs for him. And that helped pay for the frame. And then eventually I went to work for him part-time, and that's where I learned frame building. It's kind of neat because, like I say, he was born 1877 before the bicycle was even invented. And he was one of the first frame builders. He was a blacksmith. First frame builders were blacksmiths. And he still brazed the frame in the hearth of hot coals. You get the hot coals going and a bellows to blow the fire and make it hot, and then put the whole frame in, like the bottom bracket, stick that in there, braise it that way.
So no big fancy jigs and crazy stuff like today.
No, he laid the frame out on a brick floor. He had marks on the brick floor where the various tubes went. You know, frames back then always had a level top tube, and the level top tube was always a point of reference. You measured all the angles of the top tube.
How did that frame ride?
Well, it rode very well. That's how all frames were made back then.
Huh.
You know, they were pretty accurate. They were pretty accurate. They made building them that way, you know, lined up by eye and straight edge. And, yeah, they were very good frames. Like I say, he'd been building frames since 1907.
Wow.
So I learned a lot about the history of frame building and how the design came about.
Sure.
Back then, frames had really shallow angles, like 71-degree seat angles. And that dates back to the old ordinary, you know, the high wheeler.
Yes.
But if you imagine a high wheeler, the steering was nearly vertical. You can imagine sitting on a bike and your steering wheel is directly above the bottom bracket. Where would you sit? You'd have to sit way back. And that's the way they sat. And when the first chain-driven bike was built, it was built so the rider was sitting in the same position he sat on the ordinary, because the ordinary was the first EDF bike. So they built the chain-driven bike wasn't accepted right away. So they had to build it like you sit in that same position. And over the years, I mean, here I was in the 50s, that was some 60 years or 65 years after the bicycle was invented, the chain-driven bike I'm talking about. And they're still using those angles that really came about because of the ordinary that went before it.
Let me remind our listeners a second that we're speaking with Dave Moulton. We're talking about bikes in the really old days. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're back in the 50s then, and then, like I say, that was like 65 years after the bicycle was invented. And now I've progressed another 65 years or more, and I'm still talking about bicycles. I'm still involved with them. Somebody pointed out in a comment on my blog one day that it's kind of neat that all that history is only a handshake away. You know, and I thought that was quite a neat way of putting it.
It is a neat way of putting it. So let's fast forward a little bit and bring you to the States. When did you come to the U.S.?
1979.
And you went to work for our buddies, the Frazees, at Paris Sport.
Yeah. Mike Frazee was president of the U.S. Cycling Federation at the time. So he was heavily involved with the Olympics and the national team and all that. So.
You came and the first project you were working on were Olympic frames?
Yeah, the big thing about that time was aerodynamic frames. And I'd built a few frames in England. I'd modified the tubes myself by squishing them and making them mobilized. And I had a good relationship with Reynolds, because where I was in England, I was only like 25 miles from the Reynolds factory, so I was there all the time buying my tubing and talking to the people there. So I got to know them really well. When I moved to the States, I approached Reynolds and asked if they'd be interested in making some aerodynamic tubing, which they did.
I remember those frames, and I remember Shimano made a Durace AX group, an aerodynamic group. I remember that.
Yeah, I think that came afterwards. But anyway, it was one of the first aerodynamic bikes, and that tubing was also sent to France, and Gitane Company made a bike for Bernardino. He rode it in the Tour de France time trial.
So what year Olympics would that have been?
Well, it would have been the 80 Olympics, but they actually never rode the 80 Olympics because of the boycott.
Right. We didn't even go.
So we built those frames and they were never used.
How many bikes did you build for Paris Sport, which a lot of people don't know who they are? Paris Sport was a big name, an American name. Even though you were building the bikes, they said Paris Sport on it.
Yeah. I'm not sure how many bikes. I was still a one-man operation. I was building about three frames a week. And I was there I went there in January of 79, and I left there in October of 80. So I was there, a little over a year and a half.
And then you moved on to Mazzi.
Yes, I did. I was offered the job with Mazzi, and I went out there. And that was a good move.
Yeah.
Because Mazzi had me building 10 frames at a time, all the same. And I was just standing there brazing. Other people would do the finish work and all that. So I was just building, so it got me into building numbers of frames together. And like everything else, more repetition, the better you became. So I was already a pretty good frame builder, but I became an even better frame builder through the repetition I did at Mazzi. But unfortunately, after a year working for Mazzi, I built up such a stock of frames, there were several hundred frames unsold. And there was a bit of a downturn in the economy. I believe it was 1982, and they laid me off. And instead of signing on unemployment, I asked the owner of the shop if I could rent space from him and carry on building my own frames. Because I'd been building my own frames in my spare time. So by making a few phone calls to dealers around the country, I managed to get enough orders to get my business going.
How were you getting orders? How were people finding you?
I was selling them through dealers. I was calling bike dealers, and a lot of these dealers knew who I was, and then they would sell them. And they would order a custom frame, and I'd have it, I'd build it that same week, and they'd get it in within 2 weeks, which is unheard of.
Sure.
You know, and then the dealer would make a profit on the frame, and then he'd make the profit on the components and the building of the bike. And so it was a good deal for them, and, you know, it called on, and I soon had plenty of work.
How many dealers did you have in your network, do you think, at the peak?
Oh, I haven't a clue, really.
Oh, okay.
I mean, toward the end, I had dealers all over, mostly, well, in California, but Colorado had a lot, you know, and then scattered all over.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But I had some in Texas, and Atlanta, Georgia was a big area where I sold a lot of bikes. So, yeah, I had quite a network, but numbers I can't give you off the top of my head.
Yeah, I understand. So let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Dave Moulton. I want to ask you about the podcast that I watched. It's a short one. I think it's like under 3 minutes. It's up on YouTube. And it's about when you first came to the U.S. and how you thought about, and probably still think about, custom frame building, like keeping people away. Explain that.
Yeah.
I thought it was hilarious.
When I came, you know, it's an American thing. If a guy's doing something, like working on a car or something, all his neighbors are going to come out and watch him. You know, never had that in England. So you can imagine bike enthusiasts. They want to watch me building frames. When I came to Paris Sport, the frame shop was on the back of a bike shop. So there'd be a constant stream of people from the bike shop down to the frame shop and stand there all day and bullshit and ask me all manner of questions about the bike. And they'd be repeating these same questions over and over again to different people, you know, repeating the same answers. And I couldn't build bikes, and I was paid per piece, you know. So I had to work through the night to catch up. And I thought, this is crazy. So I always vowed when I had my own shop, I'd have a strict no good as a policy, and I did. I kept it up. And I sold my bikes through dealers. I let them deal with the customers and all the fitting and all that. And then I would just build the bike. And I even had an unlisted 800 number of all things, and nobody could find me. And
I think it's over awesome.
The years it kind of worked out because kind of mystique built up around this character named Dave Moulton that nobody could find, and he was building bikes somewhere. But you know, like I was performing magic hidden away somewhere. They came and saw me, or they'd find out it's some old fart building bike frames.
You couldn't get away with that today. People would hunt you down. They would find you somehow, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You could. You'd have to be under a rock or something.
I built as many as 30 frames a month. And then in the year, I built 500 frames.
Wow.
You can't build that many frames and have people yakety-yakety-yak to you all day long.
Oh, I know. I know.
You can't do that.
I know. People like to hang out at bike shops, you know, and then they don't understand why the work doesn't get done, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Talk to me about Breaking Away. I love that movie. I don't know how many times I've seen it. It had some influence on you, too.
It did. Yeah, it came out in 79, which was the year I came over here. And the star in the movie was a young guy into bike racing. And his bike was a red Mazzy bike. And Mazzy in California had actually come and gone by then. The shop had closed down. And there was a sudden demand for Mazzy bikes because of this movie. So a local bike store owner named Ted Kirkbride, he opened up a frame shop. He rented space out to other frame builders. It was like a co-op. But he started contracting to build the Mazzy frames. And that's when he brought me in to build frames. So technically, I didn't really work for Mazzy. I worked for Ted Kirkbride. Contracted to build the Mazzies, but I would say I work for Mazzy because it's easier.
So how many times have you seen the movie?
Oh, I saw it in the theater when it came out, and then I've probably seen it at least a couple of times over the years on TV, yeah.
Some great lines in that movie. I love that movie. So, you know, you've built bikes for teams and riders, and you actually built a bike for a friend of mine, John Howard. You built under his name.
Yeah,
you've had bikes in the world, the Olympics, all over the place.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about some of these team bikes, because, you know, you still have individual riders. You have to build them to fit the riders. How did you do that for teams?
Well, back in the 70s, you know, when let's back up to, as a soldier, I first learned frame building in the 50s, late 50s. But then through the 60s, there was a slump in frame building. And the only frames I built were ones I built for myself. And I did that because I was trying to build a better bike and design a better bike for myself. I had no really aspirations to be a frame builder as a business. But the time the 70s came around, cycling had picked up. There was a bike boom in the US, and things were picking up. And I started getting orders for frames from friends of mine, local club members and stuff like that. So then I was able to start a business in 74, I believe it was, 74, yeah. And so I built frames in England. And then, where was it going with it? I'm sorry. What was the question?
Oh, the question was about the teams and the riders you were building for, how you came up with these individual bikes. That's okay.
And to build up my bike business in England, I was in Worcester, which is in the West Midlands, which is a hotbed of cycling. It's about 25 miles south of Birmingham, which is a huge cycling city. Got a lot of clubs, a lot of top international riders come from Birmingham area. So these riders, I was able to build them frames, and I'd give them a frame, and they would. There was strict amateur rules back there. I couldn't advertise the fact that these riders were using my bike. But, however, if there was a picture of them in the cycling magazine with my name emblazoned all over the frame, it was obvious it was my bike, and that brought me in a lot of customers.
Uh-huh.
So there's riders like Paul Carver, the Olympics in 76. Another rider called John Paxton, who was a very strong rider. He was one of the first I built frames for, and several others. And that's it. That's how the whole sponsorship thing came. Now, in the US, it was different. I sponsored teams in the US, but it was mostly through bike stores. It was a team. Terry Shaw had a bike, Shaw Cycles, in the Bay Area, San Jose. And he had a team there, and I built frames for that team. So that meant that people in the club would buy frames from Terry Shaw, buy team frames, and then we could fly a frame to some of the top riders. So it was a partnership with Athena. I had a team, the Polytechnic team, Cal Poly,
uh-huh,
in San Luis Obispo. They had a big cycling team. I sponsored them. And also a team in Atlanta, Georgia's bike store called Cycle Works. There was a Cycle Works team. But sponsoring in the U.S. was a little different. It was in with the bike dealer. You know, the bike dealer doing part of the sponsorship and me doing part of it.
Yeah, sponsorship's a big topic these days. Can we take a short break and we'll come right back and we'll talk some more?
Sure.
All right, hang on. We're going to take a short break, and so we'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Okay, we're back, and if you're just joining me, I'm Diane Jenks. I'm the Outspoken Cyclist. We are talking with Dave Moulton, and you know what? I'd like to cover a couple of items that appear on your blog. Your blog is so extensive. If people have not seen it, it's Dave's Bike Blog, and you should go look at it if you're interested, because there are so many topics it would take you weeks to get through them. But one of the ones that I really was interested in, because I do lots of fittings and I've been doing fittings since 1984, is you have some really specific ideas about frame sizing or human sizing. Give us a kind of a short primer on the subject from your perspective.
Yeah, well, I started out, I could fit someone intuitively. You know, I could look at them and say, they need that size frame. And then when I measured them up, I was pretty close. So what I discovered over the years is that frame fitting is more linked to the person's height than anything else. You know, for example, I'm a pretty short guy. I'm 5'6". I've got a 31-inch inseam. Now, you can have a guy that's 6'4" with a 31-inch inseam. You can't put that guy on the same size bike as me. I ride like a 52-centimeter bike. You can't put a 6-foot guy on a 52-centimeter bike.
Right.
So obviously, you know, it's more linked to his height than his leg length. And what I found that if a tall person has short legs, they usually have long feet because the foot is an extension of the leg. And when you pedal a bike, you've got your toe pointed downwards. So the longer foot comes into play, so therefore his saddle, although he's got a short inside leg measurement, his saddle goes actually much higher than my saddle would. And we've both got the same inside leg measurement. So his saddle would go much higher and he'd need a bigger frame. So does that kind of answer your question?
Well, it sort of does. I think somebody should read your article if they're interested, because you have a more extensive explanation. But, you know, most bike manufacturers today, if they're making production bikes, they're making like 7 sizes, where a custom builder is going to build every frame to order today. That's the way they do it.
Yeah, well, I built on my production frame, like my Fuso, I built 18 different sizes, and they were all different. They all had different length top tubes and different angles. Different seat angles, so every frame you could do a practically custom fit from a production frame. You know, I mean, 18 sizes and a centimeter increments, that was a lot. So
that is a lot.
Yeah, and like you say, today it's t-shirts, so it's small, medium, and large. You know,
well, they do it with, you know, tall seat tubes and sloping top tubes. Few people have level top tubes anymore, right?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So that takes us to a subject that's always controversial. That's trail and rake. And you have a really good blog entry called Trail, Fork Rake, and a Little Bit of History. Tell us a little bit of history.
Yeah, well, again, you see, it goes back to what I started out talking about being learning from Pop Arch, who had built frames, you know, since the 1907. You know, back then, bikes had a tremendous fork rake, about 3 inches of fork rake. There was a theory back then that a bike shouldn't have any trail. You know, and trail is a little bit difficult to explain over the phone. Needs to be accompanied with drawings. But what it basically is a caster wheel. Caster wheel trails along behind the steering axis. So if you're on a bicycle, if you draw a line through the steering axis, it reaches the ground at a point in front of where the wheel contacts the ground.
Right.
So you maybe got 2.5 inches of trail. Well, that gives a caster action, and it also gives the bike some self-steering qualities. If you lengthen the fork rake, and you decrease the trail, and you decrease it to the point where there's no trail, it's absolutely neutral, where the wheel contacts the ground at the point where the steering axis reaches the ground, if you follow my...
But I don't know if everybody does. But you know what? They can go look at it, too. But go ahead, continue.
I have to look at the blog and those drawings there and explain it all. But what that did, it made bikes that handled, like I always say, handled like a wheelbarrow. They didn't perform very good. When you rode out of the saddle, they wandered all over the place. And so over the years, the established head angle for a bike, for a road bike, is 73 degrees. And it's been like that since the 1920s, 1930s. And it's always found to be the best angle. I always found it to be the best angle. I sometimes make a steeper angle for a slightly steeper, like 74-degree head angle for a Criterion bike. which you want to handle quickly, quicker going around corners and stuff like that. But mostly around 73 degrees, and that's still the standard today. And what that does is, you know, if a bike had a vertical head tube, 93 head tubes vertical, when you turn the front wheel, let's back up, let's say, you know, the bike is upright, the rear hub is horizontal to the ground. If your head angle is 90 degrees, you turn the head angle, you turn the front wheel, the front hub would still be horizontal to the ground, the same as the back hub. But with the head angle lean forward 73 degrees, when you turn the bike, the front wheel is leaning more than the back wheel. That's what I'm trying to get at. The front wheel is leaning more than the back wheel, and that's due to the head angle.
So what is the best? Well, maybe that's not a good question. When you built your, let's take a 58-centimeter frame, which is fairly average size, and a 73-degree head angle, what's your seat angle, and then because you probably made your own forks, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course. What would be the rake of the fork that you would use for a road bike, meaning not a time trial bike, not a track bike, a road bike?
About 1.25 inches, which is 35 millimeters.
Okay, so that makes sense. That makes sense.
Actually, my fork brakes were shorter than they are today. You know, ever since carbon forks have come in, they seem to have got longer for some reason.
Yeah.
But that was my theory. My bikes had a little more trail than the average road bike at the time.
Would that be a signature kind of molten? So people would jump on your bike and they'd know that.
You know, in the 70s, one of the reasons, going all the way back again to Todd Hodge and, you know, he telling me the theory about bike racing. Like I say, the average bike then had a 71 degree seat angle, 73 head angle. That's 2 degrees difference. So the seat is leaning back further than the head angle. So as you build a bigger frame, the top two got longer. Can you follow that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. So that suited the frame builder. You know, it made it easier. As the frame got bigger, the top two actually got longer. It made it simple for the frame builder. But it didn't really suit the rider. You know, one of the things I found in the 50s, I was always sliding forward on the saddle because I was sitting back too fast. My body needed to be further forward, and you know, there was a stern riding a rivet, which they still use today, and that's when saddles had rivets in them, and you'd be right on the rivet on the front of the saddle because your bike is seeping back too fast.
Ouch.
So I started building bikes as the bike got smaller, the seat angle got steeper, and the top tube got shorter.
Right.
But also, my top tubes were slightly shorter than average frame. And it was meant to be ridden with a longer stem, handlebar stem. It's got the handlebars out directly over the front wheel, over the front wheel hub and where the wheel contacted the ground. And it made the bike feel really lively. It handled well and felt good in a sprint, out of several sprints, for example. The Italians, on the other hand, the way they went, they kept this 2 degree difference, so nobody was prepared to go back to a 71 seat angle. They wanted a 73 seat angle, so they made the head angle 75 degrees. So that two degree difference, which again made it easier for the frame builder, but it made the bikes very squirrely and handled poorly. You know, downright dangerous if you weren't a skilled rider.
Oh yeah.
So I was able to make a shorter top tube, longer handlebar stem. I was able to still get that same lively feel, but not the squirrely handling.
How interesting. That makes perfect sense. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Dave Moulton. We are talking about specifics of frame geometry and bike handling, which a lot of people don't understand when they make changes to a bike. So they'll go and buy a bike and then they'll go, well, this is too long. They'll shorten up a stem a lot or move a saddle too far forward, and they can't understand why the bike doesn't handle right anymore. But that's part of it. That's part of it. Let's talk about tires for a second. I know that you came up in the time of sew-ups, tubulars, and now we have the advent of tubeless tires. They use that sealant in there. Are tubulars a thing of the past, or do you still think they ride better?
Oh, yeah, definitely thinking of faster recreational riding. I mean, the thing is, in the 80s, you know, most bikes I sold were fitted with tubular tires.
Right.
Because there were no decent lightweight clinchers available. You know, if you wanted to, you wanted a race bike and wanted to ride like a race bike, you had to have tubulars on it, which, you know, were a pain. The tubulars are like, the professionals still ride tubulars, you know, because they do ride better and for racing they're best. But it's okay for the pros. You know, they have mechanics that are able to glue the tires on and stuff like that. It's a real process of gluing the tubular tires on. You can't just glue them on and then go out and ride it. You know, you've got to prepare it and glue it the day before, and then it's a real process. And then repairing them is something else. They've got to be unstitched and repair them and stitch them up again. It's a real pain. I did it for years. I rode tubulars for years. But in recent years, you know, the modern clincher, almost as good, certainly good enough for recreational riding. So as far as recreational riding is clinchers are the thing.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember sewing up tubulars, and I remember aging them. And I'm, you know, all those companies are gone now. Clement is gone. All of the people who made really fine handmade tubular tires are no longer making them.
Yeah.
So that's kind of sad to see that go away, I think.
Yeah, well, a lot of things go away, and that's progress. You know?
That's true.
away,
so. Good point. All right, I'm going to ask you the C question. What do you think about carbon? Carbon.
Well, like I say, it's I really don't know that much about it. I haven't ridden it that much. There are always weight weenies out there that were obsessed with the weight of the bike, you know. I always used to say, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to weigh it or ride it, you know? And most of the time, especially for recreational riding, it makes no difference, you know, the weight of a bike. It's a subject. I don't get into it because it doesn't really interest me. I'm no longer building bikes. The whole scene has changed. When I started building bikes, every area throughout Great Britain, throughout the whole of Europe for that matter, every area had its own little frame builder, one-man operation building frames, and you would build frames for all the people in that locality. Then you'd move on somewhere else and there'd be another frame builder. It was like that all over Europe. You had a few bigger frame builders who became bigger, like in England, yeah, you had Mercian and Bob Jackson and people like that. Employ a few more people and build a few more bikes, so they're better known. But when the bike boom started in the 70s, you know, none of these companies in England were big enough to fill the demand. You know, I got a few orders from the US and shipped bikes over there. That's what led to my coming over here. But, you know, they couldn't keep up with the demand, so that's why the Italians took over. The Italians were more into production and were able to build factories, building hand-built frames, but building them on a conveyor belt system that's, you know, built a lot of bikes. So when I came over, that's who I was competing with. I was competing with the Italian imports.
I have another, before we take another quick break, I wanted to just get a quick view from you about e-bikes. Do you think that they're an important part of the bicycle business or bicycle world, this pedal assist thing?
I don't know. Again, you see, really, I haven't studied it that much. I mean, initially I was against them. I thought, why, you know, you have a bike, you have a bicycle for exercise, why put a motor on it, you know? But then people say, well, they're great for old people, you know, they can go out and keep up with the young guys. But I have no desire to do that, you know, I've gone under three. I don't want to ride with the young racing guys anymore. I go out and ride with my wife at a leisurely pace. So I've no desire to have an e-bike and keep up with the big guys, you know. So I don't know. You know, if I get into studies like this, I get accused of being a retrograde, you know. So I don't usually give an opinion either way. Again, like the carbon fiber, it's something I haven't really looked into. Got no interest in it, really, and I can't say, but you know, the big thing a few years ago was moped, you know.
Yeah, it's true. That's true.
Moped. Yep. Moped is still around, but it didn't really take over the whole bike business.
No, I don't think so either.
I think electric bikes would be the same.
Okay, that's a good answer.
What I am against is hidden motors in a bike.
Well, yeah, no kidding.
They'd be clearly seen.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're only going out for a ride with your friends, it's always competitive and it's always like an unofficial race. You know, so if you've got a motor there hidden in your bike, that's cheating.
It is cheating.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, so hidden motors, definitely I'm against those.
All right. We're going to take another short break, and we'll be right back. We're speaking with Dave Moulton. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to take the last part of our show and talk to Dave Moulton. If you didn't know, you need to rewind this and listen to the entire podcast because it's really interesting and it's really fun. I have a couple of random things I want to talk to you about. Look back in your history, which is long and illustrious, and tell us about a rider who made an impression on you. We might not know somebody who is sort of obscure.
Well, of course, you know, in my youth, I wanted to emulate the pros of the time, you know, which was riders like Coppi and Ursula Coppi and Gino Bartali and riders like that. But in a previous correspondence with you, you mentioned Beryl Burton.
Right.
Beryl Burton was a woman cyclist, probably the greatest woman cyclist ever. She was at a peak in the 60s. She was actually about the same age as me, actually a year younger than me. So her peak came in the 60s. And that's why probably not many people have heard about her in the years. But give you an example, she rode 25 miles in 53 minutes.
Oh.
21 seconds, which is 28 miles an hour. You know, and this was in 1976, which is over 50 years ago. You know, that would be an amazing ride for a woman today. You know, and this was 50 years ago, before the time of aero bars and all that stuff. It was pretty amazing. And she really excelled at the long distance. She did 100 miles in 3 hours, 55 minutes, which is like 25 and a half miles an hour for 100 miles.
Right.
She rode a 12-hour time trial and did 277 miles, which is an average speed of 23 miles an hour. Now, when she rode that race, it was a men's time trial, but there weren't separate women's, weren't enough women to ride 12 hours. The fastest man on that race was a man named Mike McNamara, and he broke the then competition record for 12 hours. He did 276 miles, 6.5 miles. Beryl Burton beat him. She actually passed him towards the end of the race and beat him in the race. That's pretty amazing. She beat a man in the race. So yeah, that was one of the kind of people that inspired me. Another lesson I learned, sadly, Beryl Burton died. She was only 59 years old, and she died on a bike. She always had an irregular heart rhythm, and when she got older, she slowed down like we all do when you get older. But instead of accepting that, she trained even harder. So she trained harder and harder, and it finally killed her. She was out on a training ride, and her heart gave out, and she collapsed and died.
Oh, no.
And that taught me a valuable lesson. You know, when you get older, you've got to slow down.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to realize you've got nothing more to prove to yourself or anyone else, and just slow down, take it easy.
Yeah. You know, some of the things on your blog are a little more along the lines, we'll take it right from what you just said, slowing down and realizing that you are a little bit older. But you have some interesting perspectives on things like guns and on distracted driving. And There's a piece on your blog from 2012 titled Freedom and People Killing People that I think is just brilliant. Here it is 6 years later, and it's still the same. I believe. So tell us your thoughts about freedom and people killing people.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to get into the whole gun control thing and open up that whole bucket of skeletons, you know.
Right.
But the thing is, I think I wrote that right after the Sandy Hook massacre, you know, when all those children were killed in the school. I guess when that came, that was a response to that. And what I pointed out was, you know, people are killing people with guns, and they all say, well, guns don't kill people, it's people kills people. And that's all very well, but a gun does a really good job. You know, if somebody went ate you with a knife or a baseball bat, they wouldn't kill near as many people as when they have an automatic gun. But anyway, the other point I made was that people kill people in cars, and it's not the cars that kill people, but it's the people driving cars that kill people. And either way, whether you're killed with a gun or killed with a car, you're dead anyway. You've lost your freedom. So one man's freedom to own a gun or drive a car like a lunatic causes another person to lose his freedom, in other words, his life. So that's what the piece was about. And I pointed out, you know, if you had a gun and you threatened somebody with it, you know, you went and threatened your neighbor with it, pointed it out, and you'd be in some serious trouble.
Right.
But you can go out with a car and you can threaten somebody with a car. You can drive real close to them, even bump into them and rev your engine and threaten them that way. There's no consequences to that.
Right.
If you run into somebody, even deliberately, you can all say, oh, sorry, I didn't see him. Whereas if you accidentally shot somebody with a gun, you couldn't say, oh, sorry, I didn't see him standing
right
there when I fired the gun in that direction.
Right.
You probably wouldn't get away with that. But you get away with it in a car. So that was the point I was trying to make in the article.
I thought it was really well written, and it was very succinct. I mean, it made perfect sense. Again, it's titled Freedom and People Killing People. If you're interested, it's on Dave's blog, and it's davesbikeblog.com, I think is correct.
Yeah.
So yeah. Do you miss building frames, Dave?
No, not really. I mean,
good answer.
There's no demand for like steel frames anymore. So I was fortunate to be in the era, like the 1980s, when I was at the peak of building frames. That was the end of an era, and that era is not there anymore. Frame building is a lot of hard physical work.
Yes.
And no, I don't want to do it now.
So even though there's a North American Handmade show and there are all these little frame builders popping up all over the country, and people like Richard Sachs and even Chris Chance is back building frames, and Ben Serrata, and you still say it's past its prime.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, like I say, I build as many as 500 frames in a year. There's not that demand for that many.
Oh yeah, true.
People can build ones and twos, you know, and build it. But there's not that demand for steel frames anymore. I built so many frames. I built about 2,400 fuser frames alone. And most of those are still out there. Most of those frames are still out there. I've got a bike registry. And I've only got about 500 or so bikes registered on this registry. In the couple of years, I've probably built at least 7,000. So where are all these other bikes? You know, most of them are still there.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And in people's attics and basements, and hardly a week goes by, and there's not two or three of my bikes for sale on eBay. You know, people ask outrageous prices for them, which is ridiculous because they're not that rare because I built so many of them. You know, so if you buy one at a true price, you can get a complete bike for around between $600 and $800. You can get a frame for about $300 and $400. And what a lot of people are doing, they're building up these older frames with the modern equipment, the modern 11-speed group, and you've got the modern equipment and the modern brakes. So you've got the best of both worlds. You've got a bike that really rides and handles nice. But at the same time, you've got the advantage of the better brakes and the better gearing.
So this registry, if people find one of your bikes or they discover one of your bikes, they can contact you and register it with you, and you'll know something about the provenance of the bike?
The serial number and the name and where they live. And, yeah, you can check that online, too. It's DaveMoltonRegistry.com.
Nice.
Or there's a link on the blog. If you find the blog, then there's a link on there.
Yeah, there is a link. So what are you doing with yourself these days, besides writing your blog, which you do?
Yeah, well, it keeps me busy. I write a lot since I retired. I wrote a novel.
Oh, that's true. The Prodigal book. Child.
Prodigal Child, yeah. And I produce a book of humor. It's like 1,000 one-line quotes and 100 cartoons. I also drew these cartoons in this book. Another book.
Nice.
And that's called I Don't Suffer From My Art.
I Don't Suffer From My Art? Is that what it is? That's good.
And inside there's a subtitle. It says it's the people that read this shit that suffer from my art.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right. So I always ask my guests three questions. What's your favorite food?
You know, I've cut down on my eating. I don't really eat that much.
Well, you eat something.
About 3 years ago, I weighed about 178 pounds. Always had a belly. It didn't matter how much I rode my bike, I still had this belly, like a lot of bike builders do, and bike riders do. And I realized that, you know, you can't just do it by exercise alone. You've got to do it by diet and exercise. So what I did, I looked up my resting metabolic rate, which is the amount you need if you lay in bed all day and did nothing. And mine is right around 1,000 calories a day. So that's all I eat. You know, I may eat a little more if I go for a bike ride or something like that. So I eat 1,000 calories a day, which is not much.
No. Most people lose weight at 1,000 calories a day.
Yeah. I mean, in the morning, I have a bowl of oatmeal with some coconut oil in it and blueberries. And honey, and that's probably my favorite meal of the day.
Breakfast is always the best meal of the day.
I'm not a big foodie.
Yeah. Okay. What kind of music do you like?
Music, all kinds of music. I actually write music. That's another thing I do in my time. I actually write music. If I did an album, I would call it Anglo-Americana. It's stories about everyday life.
You really are a Renaissance man. And what do you have any pets?
No, I'm not into pets at all.
Okay, I got it. Well, Dave, this has been wonderful. And I know my listeners are going to love it. And I really appreciate you taking so much of your time to talk with me today on the show. And I will.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I will contact you again as soon as they start like banging at my door going, we want to hear more from Dave, which they will. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great afternoon.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye. Dave Moulton joined me from his home in South Carolina. What a delightful guy. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed recording that conversation. If you're interested, you can check out the many, many topics on Dave's site, davesbikeblog.com. Also, if you'd like to see Dave perform his song, The Ass Song, yep, you heard that correct, The Ass Song, you can go to YouTube and type in MUFIC Songwriter of the Month, December 2016, Dave Moulton. Or you could probably just go type in The Ass Song and it would come up. I guarantee you will be singing the chorus by the end of the 5-minute and 43-second video. There are quite a few other interesting videos that'll pop up with Dave in them. You might want to grab an adult beverage and plan to spend some time. So next week, we'll be talking with Anthony Mocha from Rasputitsa, the wickedly gnarly gravel events up in Vermont. The Redemption Tour is coming up on September 1st, and it could be the last great training event for cross season. I'd like to thank you for listening and once again ask that if you like the show, it helps tremendously for you to add your thumbs up or comments at your podcast app. You might be amazed at how those little stars change the rankings of a show. You can always find out what's going on with the Outspoken Cyclist on our Facebook page, and I often spout off on Twitter too. So I hope you have a great week, stay safe, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.